Case number 19-3527 and 21-3023 in the case of Stephanie Steigerwald versus the Commissioner of Social Security. Mr. Fan for the appellant, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Dennis Fan on behalf of the United States. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if that's all right. The Social Security Act provides a specialized review scheme where attorneys can draw down from the benefits of Social Security beneficiaries, thus reducing those benefits. This is not properly a Social Security case. The Supreme Court has said that Social Security review is only available for review of benefits determinations, but not for redos of aspects of past benefits determinations. That same holding precludes Section 406B fees, and it precludes the $16 million Section 406B award here, because all that's happening here is that the district court required the Social Security Administration to redo a recalculate a prior payment function called the windfall offset.
But the service did not engage in this redo on their own. I mean, this likely would not have happened but for the efforts of counsel, correct?
That's absolutely correct. And the government is not up here saying that counsel doesn't deserve some amount of compensation. We're not saying that they don't get attorney's fees at all. In litigation against the government, you have attorney's fees under the Equal Access to Justice Act. All we're saying is that the Social Security Act provides what is a specialized review scheme. And so when the Supreme Court and when this court have parsed that scheme, they said, well, look, you get Social Security review of benefits determinations. You might get Social Security review of a few other things. But when there's redos that happen, and this is Califano v. Sanders, when there's redos, reopenings, anytime when you have a purely regulatory action that redoes a benefits determination, some prior function.
Matter of your discretion.
It's a matter of discretion.
Grace is one of the cases.
Yeah, Smith v. Berryhill calls it a matter of grace. That doesn't fall under the Social Security Act. And that's all we're here saying, is that we need some other source of compensation here. The government's happily up here saying there can be some other source of compensation. All that can't happen is for this money to come out of the pockets of 70,000 Social Security beneficiaries where they can pull $16 million out.
Did you challenge the merits of the district court's order that the recalculation should occur?
Do we challenge it in district court or do we challenge it in the Court of Appeals?
First, did you challenge it in district court?
Yeah, so what we...
And then did you challenge it on any appeal here?
Yeah, so what happened was once it became clear from the judgment that what was happening was not a review of some Social Security decision, the government promptly filed a Rule 59e motion to reconsider, and we said, look, based on the nature of the judgment where you're requiring us to do recalculations of windfall offsets, this isn't really a Social Security case anymore. You haven't cited a single decision of the commissioner that you're reviewing. We appealed that. That appeal, the briefing was held in abeyance.
That appeal, and correct me if I'm wrong, I thought that appeal was for the order of the district court to have a certain short time frame for the recalculation to occur.
That appeals from judgment. So everything is consolidated before this court right now. That was an appeal from judgment. This court has every available issue before it.
But the only issue you raised in that appeal, as I understand it, was the short time frame that you had.
That's not entirely correct. In footnote 5 on page 25 of our opening brief in that appeal, we said, look, we think there is a serious issue here about jurisdiction and whether this falls under 405G jurisdiction or Mandamus Act jurisdiction. And what we said is we're not going to waste this court's time right now briefing that up because in an appeal from judgment, if there's jurisdiction, you know, if there's diversity jurisdiction, federal question jurisdiction, and there's one or the other, we're not going to waste half a brief saying this is really a diversity case when it's the district court thought it was a federal question case. So that's all that happened.
So that's in your brief in the number 19 case.
That's right.
In front of us in a footnote where you're saying, hey, there might be a jurisdiction problem.
No, that's absolutely right. And I think even aside from that, Section 406B, what it requires is just from the plain text, if you want to even look at this from a fee perspective.
406B or G?
406B.
Okay.
Is that it requires a judgment under this subchapter. It requires the court to actually make some finding that says this needs to be a judgment under Title II or Title 16 of the Act.
Well, didn't the district court make a judgment saying that this recalculation of benefits had to occur?
I mean, the district court did, and it was incorrect. The district court was incorrect that this was a judgment under the Social Security Act. There are judgments under the Social Security
Act. Could have been a mandamus act judgment is your current view.
Exactly. And that's all we're here saying, which is it could have been, the judgment, as the district court ordered it, was in the nature of mandamus. When you have a judgment of the district court that requires some purely regulatory redo of a prior Social Security decision, that falls under mandamus.
When there's a payment for past due benefits, is a mandamus required to provide relief, or can the district court simply enter a judgment under 405G?
If Your Honor's question is, if there are instances where the government, let's say, issues a decision that says you're owed $10,000 and then just refuses to pay it, our view is you can go to court and you can ask for that money under mandamus. I mean, that's what Judge Friendly said in his Ellis v. Blum decision, which is it would kind of stretch your imagination, because 405G isn't just an easy judicial review statute. When you have 405G review, what that means is you have to go through four tiers of administrative review before you get to judicial review. So to say something's really a 405G case means that these plaintiffs really needed to all go through four steps of administrative review before they could have even gotten to the point of judicial review. It's not like 405G is some shortcut. And what Judge Friendly and Ellis v. Blum said was, look, 405G is actually pretty onerous. That's why we have things when it's some ministerial duty to pay a group of plaintiffs or pay a particular plaintiff where there's been a prior eligibility determination. That's supposed to be something that falls under a different statute.
So the way this transpired was this was brought as a class action in the district court, correct?
That's correct.
And it was not, did not go through the four steps of the normal case where an individual is seeking benefits under Social Security.
Yeah, so these plaintiffs have all gotten favorable benefits determinations at some point in the past. So
right.
They, at some point within
retroactive
that...
Retroactive awards.
Yeah, they've gotten retroactive awards. They went through that process. There was some initial windfall offset starting as early back as 2002 or so. What this action is about is this class action said, sometime later down the road, after all that happened, after you did your administrative review, after you had your initial windfall offset, what happened is SSA forgot to do something later. And that's what happened. SSA, and we were here and we admit that. We admitted that.
Second offset that's required only by regulation.
There's a second recalculation of the initial windfall offset. It's only required by recalculation. SSA has said since the 1980s that they've done it as a matter of policy. It's because they think it's fair. And, SSA in district court, to its credit, said, look, we think we need to do this. Our regulations say we need to do this.
I'd like to just make sure I understand your argument. Your argument really traces back ultimately to 405G. Is that fair?
I think that's fair.
I mean, let me just make, this subchapter better than I do. 406G says when a court renders a favorable judgment to the claimant under this subchapter, you can award fees, correct? And so 405G then is saying the court has jurisdiction basically under this subchapter only after the commissioner has made a decision after a hearing.
That's right.
And so you're saying this omission, this failure to perform this act of, administrative grace is not a decision And you're saying there was no hearing either.
Yeah, that's entirely right, and that's basically exactly what this court held in Sloan. And in
which
Sloan,
case is that?
S-O-L-N-E. I don't have the exact citation onto it, but you'll find it in both of our briefs.
Okay.
And it's
and I want you to hold Judge Kethledge's questions, but so the original determination hearing, you're saying, is not sufficient to satisfy the hearing requirement that you referred to and that Judge Kethledge talked about.
Oh, I mean, the initial hearing, they don't challenge that. I mean, they got favorable benefits determinations.
Right,
right. They're not
here. This is the recalculation.
Right. I mean, if you went and looked back at the favorable benefits determination and they brought it upon judicial review, you'd
so
be like, well, they're perfectly happy.
A hearing on this issue.
No, I'm saying, well, if they want 405G
relief,
there
has to be another hearing.
Yeah. But we're saying it really
nothing in this prior hearing that had anything to do with
these are
second offset, windfall offset that's at issue in this suit.
That's right. I mean, these are all based on completely subsequent events to whatever that initial hearing was.
Right.
This is, as they say, down the road, admittedly, messed up. Like, we just didn't do
when
something.
When is SSA admitting that they messed up? It was during the litigation in front of the district court?
Yeah, I mean, in the litigation in front of the district court, in our OIG reports, we said at various instances that we had identified errors that got brought to our attention through this complaint.
This complaint, then, meaning the complaint that's filed in the district court that we are reviewing?
Absolutely. And then SSA said, look, we owe a recalculation obligation to these individuals.
I'm sorry, it's so convoluted here.
Did you
concede liability in the district court case in front of Judge Gwynne?
Yes. Yes, we conceded liability. What we didn't concede is we didn't concede certain procedural issues. We said it might not be a class-wide issue. It might not be pervasive enough that there should be class-wide relief. And, in fact, you saw that there were 130,000 class members. And once we did the recalculations, only about 70,000 of them got any amount of money. We said, we're not actually sure.
All of this is in response to a district court judgment, right, where Judge Gwynne said the Social Security Administration must do a recalculation for 137.
That's not accurate.
Okay, tell
me. In our summary judgment papers, and as Judge Gwynne acknowledged in his summary judgment opinion, he said the government has already conceded that they haven't done these recalculations. In his motion to dismiss opinion, Judge Gwynne said the government has admitted that they haven't done these recalculations. All that was at issue in this case were some other ancillary side issues.
Well, what are they?
I mean, things like jurisdiction, things like whether there can be class-wide relief, things like whether class certification is proper. There are.
They don't sound ancillary to me. They sound very.
Right. I mean, they can be significant issues, but I mean, in the terms of whether there was the fundamental issue of did SSA do recalculations that it should have been doing, SSA came out pretty squarely and said, no, we paid the lead plaintiff early on once we realized we didn't do the recalculation.
Mm-hmm. So if we were to agree with you that this is not a 405G judicial review situation, what would have been the proper approach for the individual claimants if they each felt that they should have had this subsequent recalculation? Should they have gone through the four stages of the administrative process?
That's exactly the point. They wouldn't have needed to. They could have done exactly what they did here, which is go to court. If you think this is a 405G case, then what you're really saying is that these claimants should go through that four-step administrative process to even get to the door of the courthouse.
But each one of them would have had to have gone through that as an individual plaintiff. And for many of these class members who may not have had the legal sophistication, this would have basically provided them with no remedy. I mean, they would have had a legal remedy, but no real way to access it. Because this could have a chilling effect on counsel if we're not allowing for the kind of process to occur that actually occurred in this case, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of getting adequate counsel, I mean, Congress has made a determination under the Equal Access to Justice Act that the amount of compensation in government litigation, that's enough to incentivize counsel and class actions against the government that are brought. Equal EJIA fees are pretty routine. And in terms of, even if you're, you know, we're here talking about mostly the jurisdictional issue, but even if this were under Section 460, even if you thought you could get these fees out of the pockets of Social Security beneficiaries, you know, that statute still limits you to reasonable compensation. And I'm sure there are counsel that would take this case on for less than $16 million. I'm sure there are people who would say, look, if I'm going to do $670,000 of work, you know, I'll take this case on for $2 million of compensation or $4 million of compensation. I don't know what the number is, but I'm sure there's some lawyer out there who would take it on for less than the amount of retirement.
Is that the test? If there's some lawyer out there who can do this work?
Well, it's not whether there's some lawyer out there that can do this work. I mean, I'm starting from their lodestar of what their billing rates even are. But it's the test, as this court said in Hayes, is to ensure some adequate measure of compensation while at the same time protecting the benefits of vulnerable Social Security beneficiaries. And in Hayes, you can make adjustments. Under the Supreme Court's decision in Gisbrecht, you can make adjustments upward and downward. And we're not here saying that the district court can't do that. What we're saying is you can't start from a place of 670 to 1.6 million and have an award that's totally unconnected from that amount. $16 million is just not connected to a $670,000 or $1.6 million.
You say jurisdiction was proper under the Mandamus Act. I don't recall you making any objection to the idea that the plaintiffs could bring the same class action under that act. Is that fair?
That's completely fair.
So you're not objecting to the use of the class procedure?
No. I mean, the class procedure is available unless noted otherwise in statutes under, you know, any sorts of jurisdiction.
Rule 23, you know, doesn't run aground on.
You know.
And when you refer to sort of quarreling a bit about jurisdiction in the district court, that was about alternative bases of jurisdiction, not about existence. And please don't do the nonverbal. Is that fair?
Yeah.
Or is that accurate?
Well, yeah, I'll be upfront with you. SSA, in the beginning, a district court came up and it said, look, you know, they want to assert jurisdiction under the Social Security Act. We don't think it's available. If you think it's available, then they need to go through the four-step administrative review process, which they clearly haven't. But it really was at the point of judgment when it became clear that, look, what's happening is we're getting ordered to recalculate a whole bunch of payment functions that we said, well, that's really not a Social Security Act review. You're not looking at some decision in the past and saying, what's wrong with that decision? You're ordering something new altogether. And that has to be a mandamus function. That's what Sloan held, which is if you're ordering something new altogether, if you're not reviewing what the Social Security Administration did, then that's a mandamus action. And Sloan was in the context of reopenings and it discussed California v. Sanderson that way.
So just for my benefit, you're concerned about the jurisdictional issue and you're also concerned about the fee structure and reasonableness of the fee. If it's your position that fees are okay but they ought to come under EAJA or is it okay the way they're done, but it just needs to be a much lower percentage? Tell me.
Yeah, so we think it should come over under EJIA altogether. If this court disagrees with us and says Section 406B fees are available, our alternative argument is that, well, $16 million for $670,000 to $1.6 million of work is just way too much money. I mean, this court in Lasley has said even four times the amount is grossly excessive. And so when we're talking about Section 406B fees, Congress has said what you really need is reasonable fees. This isn't, as this court has held, this isn't for the enrichment of the bar. This isn't to, you know, make sure that Social Security attorneys are handsomely rewarded. It's to make sure that they're reasonably rewarded.
So if we agree with you, then you would argue that we should send this back to the district court, and should we set a limit, or should we just send it back with them for instructions?
I think you can send instructions. I mean, I think you can say things that the Supreme Court has said. You can say, look, Gisbrecht said, you know, often it's appropriate to start with the lodestar. So let's try to figure out a lodestar here that's not just a range of $1 million, but let's set something a little bit more solid. If you want to go to different rates from different states, as the district court didn't really find, this court has held, you need to make specific findings about why you're making out-of-state rates. If you have hours that are pre-judgment, you need to kind of say, why did you have 1,000 hours pre-judgment that were billed? And then at that point, you have to make some connection between that lodestar and the award finally awarded. It's sort of, why are you, and Hayes says this when it says two times, like, why are we? No, absolutely. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. William Escobar on behalf of class counsel, Roos and Ressler, and Kelly Brian Warren. 71,109 disabled and impoverished people had made it through the administrative gauntlet and qualified for dual benefits under Title II and Title 16 of the Social Security Act. They all went through the process of hearings. Decisions were made. They were found qualified and eligible for those benefits. From that point forward, the Social Security Administration had an obligation to calculate, recalculate, and pay the correct amount of benefits. That is not divorced from the final decision. That is part of that decision. They have to calculate and pay the correct amount of benefits. The case below established that those 71,109 people did not receive the correct amount of benefits that they were entitled to receive. But more than that, the case below in the record established that Social Security was never going to fix this problem. Judge Gwynn noted in the course of the case that they had failed to present any evidence that they were working on fixing this problem. They came to this court and asked for 2 years to comply with the judge's judgment, 2 years to figure out what had to be paid to these 71,000 claimants. They submitted declarations of a senior administrator who explained they needed the 2 years in order to create new systems, reconstruct records, develop a new manual, train hundreds of people, and divert resources to get this done. The whole record shows that but for this litigation, this class action litigation, this problem that had deprived 71,000 people of a total of $107 million in benefits would never have been fixed but for this.
So the question that comes to mind after your opponent's argument is, what gave the district court jurisdiction to hear the case that you filed?
That's right.
The class action to seek so that action was to seek recalculation of benefits, right?
Well, it was an action to get the correct amount of benefits that they were eligible to receive to get that paid. So there are recalculations that are done because there are fluctuating elements of income here, but it's all about getting the right amount. Eligible people are entitled to the correct amount, not more, not less. So
why could you go directly to district court as opposed to going through the four steps?
Because, Your Honor, if you look at Congress anticipated in 405G that there could be situations where a problem developed, an error, something happened where people were not getting their benefits. And what 405G allows you to do is you can challenge and have judicial review of any decision, the Smith case.
After a hearing.
And there had been a hearing here on eligibility, which then results in the amount of payments.
The hearing had nothing to do with the second windfall offset that you're saying they should have performed.
Well, Your Honor, there's no need for a hearing on the Social Security doing what they're supposed to do in calculating the payments. From the hearing that leads to eligibility, the claimant is then entitled to the amount, and it's Social Security's responsibility to make those payments. Now, in the Smith,
very... Is that, Does that mean you can go to district court anytime after you've gotten your initial award of benefits, you think there's been a miscalculation?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, the regulations that Social Security has are really helpful in this regard. In 20 CFR 404902, they provide an actual inventory of the kinds of things that are determinations that they make that are subject to judicial review. And that includes entitlement to benefits. It includes the amount of the benefit. It includes recomputation of the benefit. And it includes any overpayment or underpayment. All of these things, their own regulations identify as being subject to judicial review under 405. And that makes sense. In Smith versus Berryhill, Justice Sotomayor noted that Social Security is a massive enterprise and errors occur. And so the statute, 405G, which was described in that decision as unusually protective of claimants, provides an avenue into federal court to challenge the Social Security Administration when they're not making the correct payment because they have an obligation to make that payment.
The court made a point in that case to say that the claim that plaintiff was making was a matter of legislative right, not administrative grace.
Right.
The claim was based on a statutory entitlement as opposed to a regulation that the agency, as a matter of grace, chose to promulgate in its discretion.
And
that's different than this case.
No, Your Honor, it's not. This case is about something that's non-discretionary, the amount of the benefits.
They don't quarrel with you about the amount of the benefits to which these folks were entitled after the Title II and the other title determinations. The fight is about an offset from the amount of those benefits.
Well, Your Honor, I submit that the fight is about making sure that the eligible people who've gone through the process, had hearings, and were entitled to benefits are paid the correct amount of benefits that are due, that the Social Security Administration has to go through processes internally to carry out their obligation to make sure the correct amount is paid. That's their administrative responsibility under the statute. So the claimants here were deprived of the benefits that they were entitled to. And I go back to 405G is a very broad statute. It talks about any decision. The government...
No, it doesn't. It's decisions after a hearing.
Right, and the
it's
hearing...
It's only about the decision itself.
Well, the hearing here is the hearings and the process that takes place in getting eligibility. That's what the hearing is.
Getting the original eligibility to...
Yes, yes.
Title 16?
Correct, Your Honor, because from that flows the administrative obligation to pay the right amount. And I go back to the basic point, which is now not in dispute, that 71,000 people did not get the right amount.
Yeah.
So
it's good that you asserted their rights. But the benefit amount you're talking about is a top-line number from which, or on which, these offsets are then based. The first offset, which is adverse to your clients, and then the second offset, which is favorable. The second offset is a matter of it just regulation only. They say just based on equitable considerations they're doing it, right? That's all accurate, isn't it?
No, I don't think it's accurate in terms of the concept for this reason, Your Honor. And this is a complicated system.
Well, what part of that was inaccurate?
Because the Social Security, the benefits under the two programs, for a variety of reasons, may have to be recalculated at various points because they depend on income situations. Mm-hmm. So if they have more income, then they're entitled to less benefit.
That's the first offset.
And
right.
And yes, because of the two retroactive payments. But that goes to the fact that they're calculating the amount. All of this goes to calculating the amount of the benefit. That's the point I'm trying to make is that once people are eligible, they're entitled to their benefits. These calculations are in order to determine the correct amount of benefits?
Well, I think we're using the word benefit in different ways. I mean, the statute provides a benefit amount that the person is entitled to. And then the statute also provides that if the person is getting, I forget which title it is, but the one that counts as income. Mm-hmm. It's like the old, you know, the so-called like old age benefit. then that counts as income. And then that reduces the amount of benefit, actually, I think. But for the second offset, which is for the when the attorney fees are taken out of the benefit, well, I'm getting a little tripped up here. But the second offset isn't affecting the amount of the benefit. These offsets go to how much of the benefit that the person actually obtains, receives, as opposed to the initial determination of benefit.
No, Your Honor, when they do these calculations, and when you have this attorney's fee paid for the original path through eligibility, that gets factored in as an income situation. So they've now been charged with income. The cost of the lawyer then reduces that income. But it all goes back to what is the correct amount of benefits that they're due. In the case here is about obtaining past due benefits. So the $107 million that was recovered are all past due benefits, which puts it squarely within 406 on the legal fee provision. That's what it's about. The Congress established a specific fee award process for recovery of past due benefits, which in the Gisbert case, the Supreme Court said is the exclusive way of determining legal fees in a case where you're going out to establish and get past due benefits. So now they...
That was the initial fight.
No, Your Honor, but
that was something the plaintiffs here, class members, went through one by one, presumably.
Right.
Right. When they can recover under both titles.
Right. And when
not what we're talking about.
Well, when we discovered in the course of this case that people had not been receiving the right amount of benefits, that's what motivated bringing the class action. And in the class action, we proved that in fact there were $107 million of pass-through benefits that were due. They were due those benefits. Now, the government, interestingly enough, admitted at the beginning of the case that 405G applied. They were moved to dismiss, and they wanted to argue that mandamus didn't apply, which was cited as an alternative basis for jurisdiction in the complaint. And they said, well, mandamus doesn't apply because 405G is an avenue for them to pursue. But they didn't comply with a requirement that the judge rejected their argument on. And so, therefore, 405 would have applied, and mandamus doesn't apply. Now they've gone full circle, flip-flop, and said, well, there is mandamus jurisdiction, and there's no 405 jurisdiction. I submit, Your Honor, that in either case, once the court did have jurisdiction to handle this case. And
this is the key question, then, if you go down the mandamus path, that EJA is the way attorney's fees are calculated, whereas if you go down the 405G path, then 406B kicks in.
Well, Your Honor, I submit that if you go down the mandamus path, 406 still provides guidance and, in fact, may require the fee to be determined under that because it's about past due benefits. 406 says that is the fee structure when you get a judgment from a court that recovers past due benefits. So that's what would happen here. If the court has jurisdiction under either basis, once they do that, then the judge has to turn to the fee issue. I also submit that he could...
Do you have a case that would say that even if there wasn't 405G judicial review, that 406B would apply?
Your Honor, that hasn't come up as far as I can tell in a case. I think it's a fair reading of the provision because what has happened here is a judgment led to the recovery of $107 million in past due benefits, which fits squarely within the language of 406. And 406 doesn't say explicitly that it's tied to some other provision. Here, there were benefits under the subchapter recovered. So I submit that 406 on a fair reading would still apply. But even
this issue has not been briefed, though, in this appeal.
Which issue?
The argument you're making now, the parties haven't briefed this argument.
About the mandamus?
About that we ought to import the 406.
Yeah, I think that's correct, Your Honor. I'm responding to the questions.
No, that's fine. I just don't know what, you know, was in the briefs.
And the other thing, of course, is we also moved for fees under 406, but also the class action Rule 23H, I think it is, where a court in a class action case also has to make a determination as to a reasonable case in a case that is a proper class action. So I think there are multiple avenues here where the court would end up in having to determine a reasonable fee. And that was a task that was that under 406 is explicitly assigned to Judge Gwynne. Now, Judge Gwynne turned to that task, and Judge Gwynne, a very experienced judge, he did a very thorough analysis here of everything. He received substantial briefing from both sides. He held a hearing, the transcript is part of the record, where he probed counsel on all issues, on everything that's being discussed. And he then carefully issued a recent decision that cites all the cases that he had to follow, Supreme Court, this court's cases. And what he did is he looked at, his task was to look at a number of factors. And he went through each one of the factors. So, for example, a key factor in coming up with a reasonable fee in this kind of context is the level of success and the problem that effectively was fixed by the litigation. He gave that considerable weight, which he's required to do. He mentioned that there was a recovery of $107 million on something that he thought was an unconscionable situation, that for as many as 16 years, some of these people had not gotten that money.
But this case is different from some of the scenarios you've referenced in the last 5 minutes. The recovery here is coming out of the benefit amount that they receive, correct? I mean, the plaintiff, the fee award is coming out of the amount that the class members would otherwise receive.
Right, and that reflects the congressional intent that in a case where they're represented by lawyers and they obtain past due benefits, the Congress decided that was a fair way for lawyers to be compensated out of that. And Judge Gwynne, that's what he then tried to figure out, what was a reasonable fee. 15% is what he settled on, and he settled on that looking at all of the factors, the success, the importance of the case, the risk faced by the contingency, lawyers taking it on the contingency, the policy of incentivizing lawyers. He looked at every single one of the factors. And if we look at the fee, the reasonableness of the fee, I submit that the most important vantage point for that is from the vantage point of each one of the claimants, because they're the ones that are paying the fee. As Your Honor points out, it's coming out of their benefits. So each person is paying 15%. The average recovery here, if you do the math, was about $1,500, which would mean that an individual receiving $1,500 in past due benefits is paying a total of $225 for his portion of the fee. If it's a higher amount, the dollar amount is higher, but it's always 15% tied to each claimant's past due benefits. So if we were going to look at a chart of all 71,000, I submit that each one of these would be reasonable on their face. And in fact, they're actually paying less than they would pay on an individual case, because this was a class action. Individual claimant, one claimant cases often result in fees of thousands of dollars.
But in the individual cases, they're limited by the 406B limit of 25%. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So in a, this is basic law. Forgive me for if I'm wrong. So in a basic Social Security case, if they need to use an attorney because they don't get the administrators to give them the right amount, and the attorney wins a Social Security award of $10,000, the attorney would get the 25% taken out of the award. Is that correct?
Not necessarily, because the 25% is a ceiling. Mm-hmm. Under the statute, the court still has to determine whether it's reasonable.
But it is in the typical Social Security claimant situation. The claimant gets an award of $10,000, hypothetically, and it is reduced by up to 25% for that money going to the attorney, right?
Right. So if in that example, the fee would be $2,500. Here, most of the individual claimants are paying much less than that because of the class action efficiency here.
Okay. And then, if we were going to go with the EJIA approach, we would be saying that the government would pay the attorney's fees, so the claimants would keep all of the money, correct?
That's correct. However, EJIA is not the appropriate fee mechanism here, because in the Ginsburg case, Judge Ginsburg said 406 is the exclusive way of determining the fee when you get a judgment in a court and obtain the pass-through benefits. EJIA fees are not precluded in the sense that lawyers can apply for those.
Yes. So couldn't the lawyers here, i.e. you, apply for EJIA? You have to make a different kind of showing under EJIA. You have to show the government was terribly wrong, loose words there. And then your clients could benefit from that, because the even if we affirm the district court, the EJIA award would be the first payment that you would get, and the payment under 406 would be reduced by that. Am I correct in the basic law here?
Yes, and that's how what Ginsburg explains, that EJIA can coexist, in effect, with the 406 fee, but a lawyer can recover both of them together. You can recover the 406 fees if, for some reason, there was a payment made on EJIA, which, by the way, is limited to $125 an hour.
Yeah, but could you, you know, suppose we ruled, hypothetically, we affirmed Judge Gwynne, could you and should you seek EJIA fees so that your clients would benefit by being able to keep a percentage of the money that was the 15% fee that Judge Gwynne ordered?
I suppose, Your Honor, the government could decide that on their own. In effect, if they wrote us a check for EJIA fees.
Well, they're not going to voluntarily do that.
I'm hoping.
Putting words into their mouth. But what's to incentivize you to file a lawsuit for EJIA fees?
Yeah, and I think there isn't an incentive for EJIA fees because, as you pointed out, that often ends up in a litigated issue, because EJIA fees are not payable by the government unless the party seeking the fees establishes that their position was not substantially justified.
Yes, but apparently they've agreed that they were not justified, so the big question is, were they?
You know, I don't know that they have agreed that there was no justification. And, in fact, this was a heavily litigated case. I heard counsel suggest that somehow they gave up. They did not. They opposed every step of the way, motion to dismiss, class certification, summary judgment, discovery, up to now through the fee issue. It was a heavily litigated case.
I've taken you a long time, but maybe, Judge, do you have any other questions?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honors. Two quick points before I sit down. I just want to start on Judge Kaplich's questions about how this sort of all works. I mean, when you get a Title II and Title 16 award, it's a big bucket. You take a little piece of that bucket out, and that's the initial windfall offset. And what happens is SSA basically retains that. It keeps it somewhere in its coffers, in its imaginary bank account. And when you have a recalculation, it's that little piece that gets, a portion of that gets paid back out again if there's been a recalculation. So the
first offset's because now you're getting benefits under two titles, and one of them counts as income for purposes of the amount you get under the second title, so we're going to knock it down a little bit.
Yes.
And then if you have to pay a fee award, if you have to pay a fee award, then that reduces the amount of income that the agency attributes to the person under the first step.
There's all sorts of, and just to be clear, there's all sorts of reasons why there can be a recalculation. A fee award is just one of them. There can be changes to the month. There can be changes to other aspects of the income. But all of that is part of the sort of initial total amount. That amount has already been set at the very beginning. They don't really challenge that that was the correct amount. They don't say that that initial benefits determination was wrong. And my friend, my colleague on the other side, uses this phrase, well, this case is just about the right amount. And I think that's a really poignant phrase, because if you look at the Federal Register notice for the recalculation, the recalculation regulations, 47 Fed Reg 4985, what Social Security Administration has said is, look, you know, there's something called the right amount. I mean, that's kind of set in the initial benefits determination. But things happen down the line. We have discretion to redo these things. We're gonna choose to redo this. But SSA doesn't have to infinitely redo things. It doesn't, you know, redo things 1 year and then redo things the next year and then redo it over and over and over again. This is completely a matter of agency discretion, where they said, look, in this one-off chance that some things have changed with your windfall offset, we'll make this redo happen. And that's the fundamental point here, is that's what makes this case like Califano v. Sanders, where SSA had created a reopening procedure, which no doubt changed the amount. If you reopen your SSA benefits determination and you get a reopening that happens, that's going to change your whole benefits amount. That's going to change your benefits determination altogether. But that didn't make it, when SSA refused to reopen, a 405G case. That made it a mandamus case, and that's what the Supreme Court held. And then the last thing I'll just point out is, you know, the government has said, and I misquoted or I misstated this in my opening, but it's in the class notice order, it's page ID 1021, and the summary judgment opinion on 1065, where the district court twice acknowledged that the government said, look, we've admitted that we haven't done these recalculations. The district court has said that twice. We've never disagreed with the district court's interpretation of our briefs, because we said in our briefs. And what fundamentally...
So did you then start doing the recalculations right then, or did you wait for the judgment from the district court saying you should do them within 8 months, and then you objected to that?
Yeah, we did it for the lead plaintiff. It took us a long time, Your Honor, to actually identify who all the class members were.
Right, there were like 130,000.
There are 130,000 of them. To be frank, some of these are paper records that go way back. I mean, these are things that SSA, during the pandemic, had to go back into sort of its offices and like kind of think about how it was going to dig through the paper records to restructure and redo all these recalculations. This isn't some sort of easy task. Each of these recalculations, as we said, could take up to 5 hours of your time just to do a single one of these.
So you just said that you admitted that you, meaning Social Security, didn't do the recalculations and that you should do them.
Yes.
Okay. So am I correct that the only issue in front of us is the attorney fee question?
I think that's right. Yeah, the only issue in front of you is whether... Section 406 fees are available, and then if they are available, whether a $16 million amount is...
Okay, but you had the separate appeal.
Yeah.
That was appealing the order that you do the recalculations in 8 months, correct? And the recalculations have all occurred, correct? So isn't that appeal moot?
Yeah, so there's some debate between the parties about whether it's fully moot. The other side says, well, you know, that appeal is the only appeal from which you could challenge the jurisdictional basis of the judgment. And if that is the case, then that's not fully moot because we think the jurisdictional basis of the judgment is pretty critical as to the Section 406B fees issue. But I think both of those appeals are before the court. I think all that this court needs to decide is whether Section 406B fees are available. And I think part of that, because 406B does say a judgment under this subchapter, doesn't just say a judgment, it says a judgment under this subchapter, meaning Title II or Title 16, part of that question is whether this is properly a Social Security case. And I urge this court to either reverse or to vacate. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you both for your argument. The case will be submitted, and would the clerk call the next case?